So, this session is socialist strategy in the Australian trade unions. In just a second, I'm going to hand over to Jerem to introduce the topic. Just so people know, the way that this will work is that Jerem will give an introduction, which will go for some time. And then afterwards, there will be plenty of time for people to raise questions, points, those sorts of things. So if you have anything that you want to say, please hang on to it until after Jerem has finished speaking, and then there'll be plenty of time to speak. And on that, I'm going to hand over to Jerem now. Jerem Small is a long-term member of Socialist Alternative here in Melbourne. He's also a long-term member of the Construction Union, the CFMEU. He's on the Socialist Alternative National Committee, and he's also Socialist Alternative's industrial organiser. And he's going to be introducing this session today. So, take it away.
Thank you. Well, yeah, it's a bit of a grand title, a socialist strategy for Australian trade unions. It's a little bit like, I'm the big chess player and, okay, we move this pawn here and move that bishop there and I'll take a defensive move here. Obviously, we're not capable of that. We are too small an organisation. We don't have those sort of pretensions. But we do have a very definite approach to our industrial work, and I want to outline that today. And, of course, I want to analyse the state of Australians' unions, the causes of the malaise that we're currently in, talk a bit about the Change the Rules campaign that we're part of here in Melbourne and around the country, and talk a bit about some of the work that our individual comrades have done as well. So if I can cram that into half an hour or so to leave plenty of time for discussion. I know there's a lot of people here who are involved in different unions, long-time fighters in the labour movement and socialist movement and so on. So we'll see how we go. Start with the bad news, I suppose. And there's a bit of that, unfortunately, as you're well aware. Excellent article that people should read and reread by Tom Bramble in the current edition of the Marxist Left Review on the crisis in our unions. And, Tom Bramble is someone who's been active in the labour movement for decades, has been writing about the labour movement for decades. So when he says, and I quote, that the union movement is facing the biggest crisis in their existence, it's worth taking note. That's a hell of a big call, actually. If you recall, after the big call, I was pretty young in the 1890s, but, the unions were just about wiped out in the 1890s. Like, if you know anything about the ups and downs of the Australian union movement, to say this is the biggest crisis is quite a call indeed. I think that's entirely justified making that statement, unfortunately. And so I wanted to start by outlining the various aspects of that crisis that the union movement is currently in. First and most obviously, I suppose, you can see it in membership. A couple of years ago, there was a particular set of figures that came out from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and I sort of worked out the maths. Like, Australian unions, according to the ABS, the figures do jump around a bit, but they reckon in the course of a year, Australian unions have managed to lose nearly 10% of their members, a decline of 150,000 in a single year. So I just did the maths and worked out that the lights would go out at Trades Hall, the very last union member would be extinct in March of 2026. Now, the figures have sort of evened out a little since then, but the trend is still in the same direction. The latest figures have the Australian union movement disappearing from the face of the earth in about August 2037. So it's not like we can just sort of breathe a sigh of relief. It's, oh, sweet, a couple of decades, that'll do us. We have a serious problem on our hand. And obviously that's not just, that's a concern for all sorts of reasons, which I'm sure people in this room are familiar with, about wages at work, conditions at work, dignity at work, safety at work, and also, the Australian trade union movement is the trade union movement that gave the world the first eight-hour day. It's a trade union movement which has been the bedrock of all sorts of social movements, from land rights, women's rights, the famous green bans imposed by the Builders Labourers Federation. The prospect that that trade union movement is in some sort of terminal decline is a cause for alarm. Apart from the raw numbers of members, there's also the question of union activity. And people might have seen a report that came out a month or two ago from the Future of Work Centre. And that's interesting reading. Looking at the decade of the 1970s and the rate of industrial action, you can measure it in different ways, but the way they measured it, days of strikes per 1,000 workers, I think it was, If you compare the decade of the 1970s, how often people went on strike, compared to the current decade, there is a decline of 97%. So it's not just that we're losing members, it's that those members, you know, our activity as a movement has declined dramatically. Third aspect of the crisis is in enterprise bargaining, which I'll talk about a little bit, but the raw figures are pretty startling. Between 2010 and 2016, according to the Bureau of Statistics, or I think this is actually another government department, but the number of workers in Australia covered by an enterprise agreement has declined from 2.7 million to 2 million. So in just 6 years, that's around 25% decline. So whichever way you measure it, you know, that's some aspects of the crisis. One of the aspects which isn't really talked about, which I think underlies a lot of the other problems that the Australian union movement has, is a lack of organising. And I'll, you know, talk a little bit about this in different aspects. Thank you. One session, if you care about the fate of the Australian union movement, you should really get yourself to a session at this conference at 4 p.m. tomorrow. And it's a session being presented by the National Union of Workers. They've been out and about in the agricultural industry, in the fields and greenhouses, in the southeast of Melbourne, up in the Riverina, out near Sale and all the rest of it. This is an area that has been totally neglected by the Australian trade union movement, especially the Australian Workers' Union, which is nominally responsible for most of it, for half a century, more. And these organisers from the NUW are going out and, you know, actually organising migrant workers into unions. These are workers who, they're on, like, you know, I've sat down with them, there's just so many different visas that they're on. Plenty of them aren't even on visas at all. A workforce at risk of deportation and so on. Their boss, in many cases, is the actual mafia, like that guy that had the lobster dinner with Tony Guy, people from Victoria would know. He's one of the employers of these workers that the NUW is organising. They're actually getting results. They're actually making agreements. They haven't had all these spectacular strikes so far, but they're actually making inroads over the last 2 or 3 years in this area that has been a non-union wasteland forever. That's a good story. By contrast, where are the other bloody organising stories? We're down to 15% density, more or less, 15% of employees in the union. I would have thought every single union should be able to have some sort of active organising drive, you know, at least one going at the moment. If people can name them, you know, not just, okay, we recruit a few people before the EBA, but a serious systematic attempt to conquer new territory or reconquer lost territory, I'd love to know about it. And I think that really, gets a step closer to the cause of the problems, but I'll come back to that, the lack of organising. And I guess the final way I'll talk about where you can see the crisis in Australian unions is in the incredibly long, protracted disputes that we're having at the moment. And people would know about the absolutely heroic struggles which have happened in Victoria and around the country over the last couple of years. 185 days on the picket line for the CUB maintenance workers, 55 of them, and they got a result. They got a decent result, they got their jobs back, they got their conditions restored, they got a pay rise, got the scabs taken out of the workforce. It was a decent result that they achieved. That actually stands out, though, compared to the other long disputes which have been happening around the place. Part of the reason is that CUB maintenance workers, like, you know, this is very advanced industrial machinery. These electricians and those fitters and turners had, in many cases, helped to design that machinery, had maintained it over decades, had helped to build it and helped to maintain it over decades. So you can't just get some average A-grade electrician or whatever to, you know, like, okay, you know, fix this up or whatever. So them sitting out on the gate, even though they didn't block scabs going in, even though they didn't shut the brewery down, in one sense, yeah, it was a pretty passive industrial strategy, but they had irreplaceable skills that the boss needed and just couldn't find replacements for. That's not the case for most workers who have been involved in these long disputes. So you look at Fletcher's. I know a lot of people went down to Fletcher Insulation in Dandenong, 96 days on the picket line. Okay, they took a couple of the hard edges off that boss's attack, but they lost their 35-hour week. Like, they lost a lot when they went back in the gate. The Myrtleford pulp mill, Plymouth, which I visited up in country Victoria. I think they were out for, about 11 weeks or something, and went back in defeat after a pretty vicious anti-union campaign. The Oakey North dispute, which, I don't know the details, but, they've basically been forced back into the workplace with, pretty much a version of the shit agreement, that they rejected in the first place. We're also in an environment where pretty much every bog-standard suburban enterprise agreement dispute, the boss is looking around and thinking, OK, it's time to have a go. So Australian Paper, up in Preston, in Melbourne, the workers there wanted a rollover agreement and 2.5%. They just wanted what they had, basically. Some of them, one of the delegates there I talked to, had been there for 14 years. She's still on $21 an hour. All they were asking was the same plus 2.5%. The boss basically said, nah, stuff you. We want your roster days off you. We want changes in rostering. We want a freeze on anyone paid basically above $21 an hour, and so on. They were out, I think, for 7 weeks before they got a resolution to that. I don't know that it's fully resolved, but it looks like, they basically got what they were after. I haven't been down to your cult. I don't know whether comrades from the NUW are here yet. So maybe we... Okay. But, which is great. But again... Yeah, so it's not like they were asking for a lot and they had to go out on strike for, a couple of weeks, face injunctions and all the rest of it to get it. So that's the sort of environment that we're in. The blood's in the water. Every boss is saying, oh, okay, let's really have a crack. Okay. What we do about the crisis depends very much on what we see the cause of it being. So I want to briefly run through a few of the arguments. And again, Tom's really excellent article. He goes in depth through a lot of the arguments which are around the union movement about why this crisis is happening. It's really worth a read. So I'm not going to do it justice. We can come back in the discussion. But a couple of things about that. One of the most common explanations that I've come across is basically that the working class has changed. The car plants have closed, which is true. All the good union jobs are going. We've now got all of these service jobs, people with no class consciousness or whatever. You can have a long argument about that. I think it's basically a totally false argument. Yes, the car plants have closed, but as Tom points out, for every car plant that's closed, there's a new hospital or shopping mall, big concentration of workers, a university, which is a massive concentration of workers, airports, which is probably the biggest concentration of workers in a modern city. These are the new working classes that have to be organised. Since the birth of capitalism, some sections of the working class have been, automated, relocated, just, done out of existence, and there's a new working class to organise. So the question is, how come our union movement hasn't been capable of organising that? Second explanation, supposed explanation, is the rise of insecure work. People are simply too insecure, everyone's been Uberised, casualised, labour hire, whatever. And, it is, there's plenty of insecure work around. Tom goes through the statistics, though. The extent of it is generally overstated, including by people in the union movement. Uber, Airtasker, all of that sort of stuff, it's pretty, it's a pretty marginal place in the labour force. Even labour hire, I think, is less than 2%. A lot of these jobs, there used to be odd jobbers, I'll do your gardens or, mulch your garden or something like that, and they're just, put ads in the local paper. Well, now they do it on Airtasker. It's not like the nature of the work has changed. So it's not like there's been this massive transformation of work for most people. It's also the case that unions have declined everywhere, not just in the Uberised sectors, but in places like the public sector, which in many cases still have, long-term, relatively secure employment. So just saying, oh, there's more insecurity, therefore people won't join unions, it doesn't hold water. And finally, of course, part of the point of unions is to win secure work. So, it can be, you're mixing up sort of cause and effect there. To the extent that people are in insecure work, it's because we have weak unions. It's not the cause of those unions being weak, if people follow what I mean. Plenty of people, dockers, insecure work back in the 20s. Here's a bunch of chips, fight for them, for who can work today. They managed to be one of the stalwart sections of the working class. So it's it doesn't really explain anything. The same sort of problems apply to explanation, the corporations have more power now. I think the corporations that smashed the Shearers Union in the 1890s had a fair bit of power. I think BHP back in the 1910s and 1920s had a fair bit of power. Like, it's not like corporate Australia has pulled this power out of nowhere. Like, it's mixing up cause and effect. Another explanation of why the union movement is in decline is because of broken rules. And I'll be talking in a separate section about the broken rules campaign or change the rules campaign. And I think that there definitely is more to this one. Firstly, the rules are bloody well broken, you know. From time to time, I invent a new email address and subscribe to Workplace Express, get this, you know, daily horror story from what's happening in the tribunals. There's one before Christmas. A stoppage of, in the words of the learned federal court judge, about 10 minutes on a Footscray construction site cost the CFMEU $242,000.
Wow.
People know Daniel Grollo and his fall over wall a few years ago, murdered three people due to his industrial negligence. He got fined about that amount. So, you know, actually mass murder is a hell of a lot cheaper than running a serious industrial campaign there. So, yeah, the rules are definitely broken. People would know about the RTBU, the Rail Union in Sydney that had its strike banned and so on. There's, you can go through all of the examples. There's a couple of legal precedents which have been won under the Fair Work Law, which are important. I don't have the time to sort of go into the ins and outs of it, but there's the John Holland case, which was, I think it's 2014. Construction company got about five people to sign an agreement and then imposed that agreement on several thousand workers that were working on the Royal Children's Hospital in Perth. And that was appealed and appealed and appealed. And the federal court, might have even gone to high court, said, yeah, sweet, no problem. So that is the template that has now been rolled out at CUB, out at Longford, with the SO workers and so on. They get some, you know, like basically a bunch of people with no connection to the workplace sign an agreement. Okay, now everyone in this workplace, the contract's changed, the contractor has changed, here's your new EBA, take it or leave it. So like that is a very significant legal loophole, that's certainly having an impact. The other important legal precedent is the Aurizon case, which is the case in 2015 where, like, to try not to get too technical, it used to be when you negotiate an enterprise agreement, you start from what the last enterprise agreement was. So if you're on $40 an hour, you've got all these breaks, you've got 5 weeks annual leave, that's the starting point for negotiations. The expectation is you might go a bit forward or a bit backwards, but that's your starting point. Aurizon succeeded in terminating the previous enterprise agreement. So instead of starting from that point, you go right back to the legal minimum of, you know, whatever it is, $21 an hour, 4 weeks annual leave, you know, like the absolute bare basics. So it dramatically skews, the power of the bargaining table. It means that, you know, unions used to be able to sit there and say, well, we don't agree, and we'll just hang on to what we've got. Now they can sit there and say, well, we don't agree, and they basically lost half of what they had. So that's a very dramatic case as well. There's been a lot of high-profile cases of EBAs being either terminated or threatened to be terminated, Murdoch University being one of the latest high-profile ones. So the rules are definitely broken. The thing is, though, when you start looking even at those laws, you see that there's a bit more going on beneath the surface. And again, Tom goes into this. Aurizon, that's the former Queensland Rail Company. Over generations of struggle, you know, those workers built up some pretty damn decent conditions in terms of rostering, limits on management prerogative, decent wages and so on. Problem is, once Queensland Rail's privatised, okay, all of those conditions go on to the new, Aurizon workers continue on with them, but now there's competitors in the market, and the rail union was, I don't know what happened up there, but they were basically totally unsuccessful in organising their way into those other rival companies. That means that Aurizon can then go to the Fair Work Commission and say, look, you know, we've been crucified here. We've got all these sweet conditions. Our competitors don't. It's the same industry. What's the deal? And the Fair Work says, yeah, fair enough. Okay, we'll scrap the agreement. So you can get away without organising. In Australia, a lot of unions have been able to get away without serious organising for decades, like for a long time. And those wages and conditions have been effectively propped up by these sort of institutional arrangements. What we're seeing in the last few years is those institutions, you know, in terms of Fair Work rules and so on, just being kicked away. So it's now much more a contest of, okay, how much industrial power can you actually muster? And if you've been neglecting your organising for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, whatever, the honest answer is not much. And a lot of unions are being found out now. So, yeah, the other thing to say about broken rules So, yeah, my point is, like, it's not just a matter of, you know, these rules are broken. Like, there's actually something else going on. There's a more fundamental malaise in terms of the lack of organising in the Australian union movement. The other thing to say about broken rules, of course, is that bad rules can be, broken rules can be broken. You can actually defy the law. We refer a lot to Clary O'Shea. Like, I always sort of think, oh, yeah, everyone knows the Clary O'Shea story. But every time I tell this story, I find, oh, thanks for that. I actually didn't know what it was. So this is, see if I can get away with the two-minute version. 1960s version of the Fair Work Laws was called the Penal Powers. Basically, if you step out of line, you go on strike when you're not meant to, your union gets hit with massive fines, and this turns the union officials into police for the industrial court. Ah, we're going to go broke if you guys go out on strike. The rest of our members won't thank you, so really you better pull your heads in and so on. It was very effective in reining in industrial militancy all through the 1950s and well into the 1960s. Beautiful talk yesterday from Liz Ross in this room about how that, you know, all got blown apart, and a rising tide of industrial pressure and also the political ferment of the late 1960s, you know, students burning their draft cards, all of that sort of stuff going on, created this culture of sort of defiance. So when Clary O'Shea, the leader of the Tramways Union, got sent to jail, got sent to Pinkridge Prison by a justice of the industrial court by the name of John Kerr, there was an industrial explosion. So this was the, and O'Shea was sent for not fully complying with the penal powers at that time. This is the front page of the Herald that afternoon. O'Shea goes to jail for contempt, trams and trains out, protest stoppages on tomorrow. So that was the start of it in May 1969. 2,500 unionists in the street escorting O'Shea to the industrial court. It's deliberate disobedience, says some. I don't know, there was. The next day, the Herald, O'Shea stays in Pentridge Jail, so it's trams, trains, gas out. Nice little map here when it comes around of all of the strikes happening in Perth, Darwin, around Sydney, Wollongong, Mount Isa, I think, in there. So, like, you know, union after union saying, nah, that's it, we've had it. Yeah, blackouts forecast, so the power workers are joining in, and so on. It's after a couple of days. Court calls in the parties, no progress, more strikes ahead, union tells judge. It's just more of the same. So a picture of some bloke, and you know, there's no tram, so he's having to walk to work, all this sort of stuff. After a week of rolling strikes, starting in Victoria and moving around the entire country, this was the headline. O'Shea freed, so rebels call Friday strike off. And this well-heeled, well-connected ruling class donor basically decided to pay the fine that O'Shea was in contempt for. So basically, you know, our side has succeeded in terrorising the ruling class. That made the penal powers a dead letter. Okay, that's a classic case, 1969. But it took the ruling class a long time to put the genie back in the bottle. Even, and that's another great thing about Tom's article, he quotes from this guy, Creighton, I think you say his name. He's no radical, he's like one of the legal scholars who co-wrote the standard legal textbook on industrial law in the 1980s. And he's just sort of summing up the industrial wisdom of that time, and he says, there is clear evidence to the effect that penal provisions, criminal or civil, can only work for so long as those to whom they are directed are prepared to allow them to work. If trade unions and their members decide that they are not prepared to accept the legitimacy of the sanctioning process, then those sanctioning processes are ultimately doomed to failure. It's a little bit long to put on a banner, but yeah, it's pretty decent. And that was just a common sense in the ruling class. I think that was 1982 that was written in. So, so that's the other thing to say about, oh, it's all because of the laws. Well, yeah, it's a reflection of something deeper. It's also a reflection of union passivity. Rather, you know, which then reinforces it, but it's not the original cause. Okay, the actual cause that Tom identifies in his article is political at root. And in his explanation, also in the terrific book, if you want even more detail in terms of the history, nothing goes past this book in terms of post-war Australian trade union history. The accord, the Prices and Incomes Accord of 1983, is the central turning point where the militancy of the 1970s was reined in. Our side no longer goes out on strike to win wages and conditions and so on. Instead, our side, our So it's negotiators, get our shiny black shoes under the table, and we negotiate a tripartite deal. Strikes are policed by the unions, and the level of industrial disputation falls and falls very steadily from that point on. So, so that is basically... I've got more detail on that. I guess the important thing to say about that, it's not like the Accord just sort of came out of a clear blue sky, no one was expecting it. Oh my God, how do you deal with this? There's always been a contest in the unions. Trade union officials are under a lot of pressure. They're under pressure from the industrial courts, they're under pressure from the employer, and, over history, and Tom goes through this, that creates trade union officials as a bureaucratic layer which has an inherent conservatism. And this is, if you could just point to one or two instances of it happening, you'd say, oh, okay, it's just a bad egg or whatever. It keeps happening across the world time and time and time again. There's a whole analysis, sociological and political, that goes with that. I don't have time to go into, so I'm just asserting it. But the thing is, up until the late 70s, there was an alternative tradition within the working class movement of militancy, of strikes, and so on. You could say a lot of awful and very true things about the various communist and socialist parties that were around in the 70s and the 80s and so on, but they did help to inform the worldview of a generation of radicals and to some extent to link up people across different workplaces, across different industries and so on. So it's in my reading, you can read a lot of articles about union decline around the world, none of them talk about the decline of the left. I think that's one of the fundamental factors. The cadre that can actually go out and organise these new industries, without a radical left, simply isn't being generated. So, in a nutshell, that's pretty much the argument that Tom makes. Okay. Solutions. Easy 5-point plan to revive the unions. So, and it sort of comes out of everything I've been saying, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. Number one, it's got to be founded on strikes. It's the greatest weapon that we have, under capitalism, is the ability to withdraw our labour. Any strategy that, I'm not against using social media or whatever, but one more Twitter storm, I'm going to scream. That is our power. We have to orient to it. Even if we have no tradition of industrial actions in our industry, even if we're pitifully weak, unless we're facing in that direction, we're going to end up in some pretty bloody strange places. So number one is an emphasis on strikes. Number two is a serious emphasis on organising. And by that, there's many, many books and, there's a whole study of the art and craft of organising. But having looked at, okay, we're heading towards the lofty heights of the class struggle, and then you have to look down from those lofty heights to where your feet actually are, and take one tiny step and hope you don't get knocked over or something like that. That's what organising is. It's finding those intermediate steps, finding those issues and just doing that basic face-to-face work. And there's very little of it. You get out more than most people, I think. There is very little actual organising that goes on in the Australian trade union movement. That would be number two. Number three, an emphasis on defiance, I've pretty much already covered. And number four, an emphasis on radical politics. There's a whole separate talk.